Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage family therapist, an educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we all struggle with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Hello, Elizabeth.
You sound so anxious.
I might be.
Well, you know, if anyone looked ahead to see what today's topic was, and maybe a lot of people are feeling a little bit anxious, but I just want to say up front, for those of you that are driving carpool or picking up the kids after school or, I don't know, with mixed company of some sort, that we're going to talk about sex today. Hence Brian's anxiety just reading the introduction. And I noticed that as I came through the station, not many people wanted to engage in conversation with me today.
Yeah.
A little afraid of the question I was going to ask them and the question that I asked my poor husband today, because it's, you know, it's something that's on my mind since we are going to be talking about sex today is, you know, what's your earliest memory of your sexuality, of feeling sexual? And how did that influence your life? Those very early experiences around sex and sexuality become the story of who we are as sexual beings all the way into our adulthood. So we're going to be exploring that topic today. Keeping it tasteful, of course, in keeping with the show week after week. I hope we stay within the realm of tasteful, but hopefully also getting to that place of feeling a little uncomfortable and anxious and worrying if we're doing it right, because our sexuality and our sex lives are at the core of our human experience, and yet we spend very little time, if any, talking about how it works. For each of us, it's different. So that's going to be where we end up today, or where the path will be going down. And there's a lot of different routes to take this conversation. You know, my initial feeling was about just our sexuality in married couples and how that works, you know, because long-term marriages have lots of different ways that the sexual relationship goes. And so I thought we can talk a lot about sex within marriage. But then, of course, yesterday was the first day back at Poly and here I'm with my students. And so I'm just immersed in that culture of confusion of this age group, you know, from 18 to 28 of trying to figure out relationships and sex and sexuality. And we hear a lot of conversations about hookups and the hookup culture and how did we get to that place? So we can, you know, explore that area a little bit and then talk about the interplay between sex, sexuality, and relationships and emotional connection. And to me, I think that's the overriding theme, no matter what our age is what is the dance? What is the connection between sex and intimacy or sex and relationships in our emotional lives? And how does our culture either support or prevent us from really having healthy, connected, committed, sexually satisfying relationships? So that's where I'm at today. How about you, Brian? Where are you at today? That was the easiest of all the questions I'm probably going to ask you.
Yeah, I know. I don't know.
I mean, we'll start with the question that a lot of people get asked. How did you learn about sex? Who taught you about sex?
My mom did.
I love that. And I know your mother. She's a wonderful person. I'm not surprised. Mm-hmm. So did you have like a sit-down conversation? Son, let me tell you how it is.
I think it was. It was along with a cartoon movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, when it was happening, she was showing me this stuff. I felt like I was too young and didn't need to know about any of it.
Mm-hmm. It wouldn't apply because you'll never feel that way.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And I barely got a grasp of what it was.
But did you feel then comfortable going to your mother after that when you had questions, or was that the last time the conversation came
out? No, I guess I was a little more, I wasn't embarrassed. I felt free to talk about it. So maybe that was the good part of it, I guess, start doing it earlier like that.
Well, it's interesting because I think maybe you're a little over the millennial age range. Are you considered a millennial, you think?
No, I'm a generation Y.
So yeah, the the tweeners. Because what's interesting about kind of this new generation of young men, different than my husband's generation of men, is that your generation talks about feelings and relationships and emotions much more readily and easily than your father's did. And I think a lot of it has to do with how many young men were raised by single moms or divorced moms, and so that moms were taking on much more of that role of having to be mother and father to their sons and be comfortable with that. And, you know, it's statistically between 58 and 71% of all parents have the talk with their children in some form. So that's a fairly good statistic of people that, you know, have the conversation. The question always is, is it enough conversation? Did it come at the right time? My mom was also, and this was, you know, forever ago, my mom broached it with us. And I think, I want to say I was in third grade, like 10. But I could be completely wrong. My mom can call and correct my storytelling. but I remember there was a book involved from the library, a couple books that she left. She said, you can read these. And if you have any questions, we can talk about it. And so I remember, you know, reading through them a little bit. And I didn't have any questions, but I had the same reaction that both of my daughters did, you know, years and years later when I had the talk with them. And I don't know if you got to this point too, but there is a period of time between your parents telling you the birds and the bees and the story, and it usually involves you meet someone, you fall in love, you have these strong feelings for each other, and they'll make you feel like you want to share something deep and special with each other, and that's, you know, intercourse. And so they, right, it goes through all those steps.
Yeah.
And you listen intently and go, I'll never do that, but thanks for the information.
Exactly.
Sounds disgusting. And then your parent leaves and you think about it for a while. And then you have that moment where you think, do my parents do this? Right? And then I remember thinking that about my parents and knowing deep down inside full well that they did, because my parents from the time I was young, what they did really well was model this very healthy, passionate, romantic love for each other in front of us, you know, appropriately, but they were very affectionate and always, you know, looking out for each other and hugging and kissing. So as soon as I made the connection between the story my mom had told me and then knowing my parents, I knew what they were doing, and then I wanted to move out of the house, right?
Yep.
So I remember my daughters having the same experience, and then the conversation stops, right? Because there's not a lot after that. Once you realize your parents are doing this thing that they just told you about, and then you wake up to those feelings within yourself and you realize, I'm having the same feelings that my parents are acting on, and now how do we have that conversation? So even if we do well when our children are young, kind of initiating the conversation, talking about the values and beliefs, you know, around our bodies and sexuality, or even the mechanics of how our bodies work and sexual health, there is a point where that conversation kind of stops because it gets too uncomfortable. A lot of young people are embarrassed to go to their parents with these questions because they don't want to freak their parents out, right? A lot of young people are afraid their parents can't handle even hearing what the young person wants to ask. Mm-hmm. So they're protecting their parents' feelings. And then a lot of times they don't know what to ask because they don't have experience with it. So a parent might say, if you have any further questions, come to me anytime. I'll be happy to answer them. But the young person won't know what questions to ask. So even if we do well at the beginning, we have this big lapse of information that happens around adolescence and then doesn't seem to get better. So I will let you off the hook at this point because I can see you backing towards the door.
Thank you.
But we are going to continue this conversation. This is A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. We meet each Tuesday to have conversations like these, a little uncomfortable, hopefully a little timely, something that we do think about and wonder about in our lives. And we provide the space for you to be part of the conversation also, to share your thoughts and experiences on the topic. Our number is 805-781-3875. The first question I put out there is, where did you first learn about sex? And was that adequate? Did that help you along your path of sexuality as you grew into adulthood and into your long-term relationships? Where did that information come from? And if you think we're doing a good job of educating young people, I'd love to hear that. And if you don't think we're doing a good enough job educating young people about sex and sexuality and intimacy, what should we be teaching young people? What is it that they should be learning? 805-781-3875. You can also be part of our conversation on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, at our website, thereluctanttherapist.com. Previous shows are always available at kcbx.org under the News Talk tab. And then we do, we are available as a podcast through iTunes, A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And you see the little KCBX label on there. You'll know that's us, and the shows will download over and over. All right. So the thing that's interesting for me, I'm just going to give a little back history. So as a therapist, you know, having gone through training to work with families, marriages and families, and you would think that sexuality would be a big part of that training. But the dirty little secret is in basic therapy training for psychologists, psychology for LCSWs, for therapists, we have very little direct training on dealing with sex and sexuality in couples. I had, I think, one course, one quarter, and it was very broad. And it was actually very interesting because my school, Pacifica, is pretty progressive when it came to this training. So it was very broad understanding of all different kinds of sexual issues and relationships and partnerings. And so it was very broad, but nothing really specific in how to work with couples that are struggling with sexual issues. And so for couples that are coming in for therapy, quite often sexual struggles are at the heart of what brings them into counseling. But most couples' counseling is very desexualized. It's not part of the conversation. A lot of the focus is on communication skills and relationship skills. And the idea is that if we can help with relationship skills or communication, the sex will follow, that somehow they'll find their way to each other. And so that's unfortunate right off the bat, is that this place that we think we could go to for help with our sexual relationships, unless you find someone who's specifically trained in sex therapy or sexual relationships, it's a challenge to get someone who's very comfortable. And the other, you know, dirty little secret is that a lot of therapists themselves are very uncomfortable with the conversations about sex. Because if you're feeling uncomfortable right now having this conversation, that's probably more of the norm than people who very easily want to sit down and have a conversation about our bodies or our sexuality. And because therapists are people like the rest of us with training in specific areas, a lot of them carry their own kind of hang-ups or fears or concerns or anxieties about sex and sexuality. And therapists, you know, can really only take couples or clients as far as they themselves have gone or ventured or explored. And so if you have a therapist who's uncomfortable with their own kind of sexual being, it's a challenge for them to go to that place. So that puts the therapeutic container as a tough spot for going to get answers and information. The other thing that is interesting to me is that the sexual revolution of the 1960s that was supposed to help liberate us all about sexuality and talking about our bodies and talking about our relationships really had a different outcome than I think was first anticipated. You know, coming out of this very repressive era of the 40s and 50s, and, you know, everything's very black and white and very quiet and private and behind closed doors. And again, it doesn't mean there wasn't a lot of sexual energy or tension happening since the beginning of time. But in the 50s, we had an extra repressive era. But it all kind of blew up in the 60s with, you know, the advent of the pill and with the work of Masters and Johnson and, you know, with the music changing and, boy, the music of the late 60s, right, was you know, all of a sudden I can't think of any of the songs I want to say, but Let's Get It On and Let's Spend the Night Together, the Rolling Stones, and, you know, moving into the disco area, Donna Summer's music. I mean, it was all very sexualized music. It was all very high energy. Censorship laws about pornography started to be overturned. All of a sudden, you know, there was a lot more pornography that was available. Movies that came out, you know, were much more explicit. We started to have, you know, early 1970s, Deep Throat, Linda Lovelace became like a mainstream movie. I mean, there was this incredible change in the whole culture around sexuality. Books like Fear of Flying by Erica Jong, Everything You Wanted to Know About Sex But Were Afraid to Ask. In 1969, it was the most popular nonfiction book of all time. And this is where kind of my sexual memories start to come up, because with Woody Allen did a movie, right, of the same title in 1972. And I remember going to see that at the drive-ins and, you know, being a little shocked and overwhelmed. But the whole world of sex and sexuality in my coming of age period of time in the 70s, it was just out there in your face, very readily available. And it just continues to snowball through the 80s and the 90s, you know, with advent of technology and, again, moving into hookup cultures and casual sex and online dating, and now with Tinder and Grindr and all these ways to access each other sexually. For all of the ways we feel like we've become liberated, we wildly overestimated the power of all this freedom to have sex whenever and with whomever we wanted to, because although we have the ready availability of sex, we also wildly underestimated how deeply people wanted to have the emotional connection invested also in their sexual relationships. And so it's as if we tried to separate the two, right? The sexual feelings and the emotional connection from each other. And the more liberated, the more kind of free our sexuality became, the further away we became from the emotional or intimacy that was also connected with sexuality. And so we find ourselves here in 2016, kind of with this huge chasm for adults and for young people, as we don't have a starting point for how to talk about sex, because we've now separated out the act from the emotions, and no one's really quite sure how to bring the two back together or why the two are so far apart. If you're just tuning in, I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. You are invited to be part of this conversation, 805-781-3875. What do you think about sexuality in our culture today? How did you first learn about it? Are we doing a good enough job of teaching or sharing our sexual values with young people today? My concern is that we talk a lot about sex, but we don't talk a lot about sex. Does that make sense? We see a lot of sexual images, you know, Sports Illustrated, Victoria's Secret models. It's all kind of tied into body image and this kind of salaciousness of showing the human body almost like disembodied, right? We look at the body as this sexual vehicle, but we disembody it by kind of taking the emotional piece out of the sexual connections. So I want to talk about kind of those reasons why people have sex. Because I love the research around it. 237 distinct reasons were given for why people enter into sex. The most common were attraction, makes sense, pleasure, affection, love, romance, emotional closeness, arousal, the desire to please, adventure, excitement, experience, connection, celebration, curiosity, and opportunity. Then mixed in with all of the 237 reasons were also some negative responses that people gave for why they had sex. And that include revenge against a partner, to gain advantage, maybe a raise or enhance social status, and to make another person jealous. And when they took all 237 of the reasons, they kind of consolidated them down to four different reasons for sex in our lives. So first one is the emotional component, sex as a way to communicate love and commitment. And I think for a lot of people, when they're young or as parents trying to teach our children or those enter into a marital relationship, you know, the sexual component of an emotional relationship is about how we communicate love and commitment to each other, that they're very intensely tied. That we express our love through each other through our sexuality. And so you can imagine then for a marriage, it becomes very indicative of the quality of the relationship, how much sex you're having, right? If a couple feels like they're both getting their physical needs met, that tells them that the health of their marriage is very strong. But when the sexuality or the sex in a relationship starts to wane, either because the couple gets really busy or kids come into the picture or there's physical ailments, you know, something that's preventing the couple from being sexual, what happens is that that breakdown of the sexual connection can really inhibit the intimacy or the love, the sense of love and commitment in the relationship. And so when you have your sexual health wrapped up into the emotional health of the relationship, when one goes, the other starts to go, and the couple, the union, starts to break down. For others, another theme of sexuality is the physical aspect. Some people, through periods of time in our life, especially young people, or maybe in periods of time that you're single or divorced, that you look upon sex as basically a physical experience, sex for pleasure, and sex as a way of meeting others and having sex because you're attracted to the other person. And that would kind of bring us to what we hear a lot with, you know, sexuality on college campuses, this hookup culture that's kind of driven by, you know, the physical aspect of, we assume that young people are getting together just because their testosterone is on high alert and they are just feeling lusty and jumping on each other whenever possible. But what's interesting is that when surveyed, most college-age young people, when they talk about the hookup culture, 57% of them say that when they go into a hookup experience, their hope is that it's going to jumpstart a long-term relationship. The majority of people who participated in casual sex or casual pairing up were hoping that it would somehow lead to something more long-term, that they weren't really just separating out sex for just a physical sake. Maybe they enjoyed in the moment, but the hope underneath that it would lead to an emotional long-term connection. The other thing that's interesting, and I was reading research by Helen Fisher, who's written many great books, but one is Anatomy of Love. And she works for, I think it's Match.com. And so they do a lot of research into, you know, singles in America and dating in America. And so they interviewed, I mean, like 5,000 people between the ages of 21 and 71. And she said the most interesting thing is that 1/3 of all Americans are single at any given time, 1/3. And of those 1/3, only 57% of them, men and women, had sex with anyone in the last year. So we have this culture that, you know, puts out all of these sexual images all this time, and this idea that everyone's having sex every minute and wearing lingerie under their, you know, business suit and getting ready to whip off their clothes. But the truth is, on college campuses and in adult relationships, that desire for more intimacy or more connection still overrides just sex for the pure sex sake. Does that sound right? I mean, because that's not the message that we get.
Right. Those are two interesting facts that wouldn't have thought. I thought it would be opposite on both of them.
Right. Because you think that single people would be having sex all the time, mm-hmm. because you see Tinder and Grindr and all these, you know, kind of hookup sites.
Right.
And then all the dating sites. But they really aren't, according to Fisher's research and Match.com's. The other thing that was interesting, they found that of men and women who went on sites like Match.com, you know, to date someone, only 8% of the men surveyed said that they were looking for sex on the first date as their motivation for going to these dating sites, and only 2% of the women. So again, that kind of flies in the face of the cultural message we continue to get, which is everyone's having sex all the time, and if you're not, somehow there's something wrong with you, and so jump on the bandwagon. Mm-hmm. It's a totally different story when you get to reality. If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. We are talking about sex today, at least so far. I'm talking about it. Brian wants to crawl under his microphone. but I'd like to ask you to join the conversation. And I know it's like one of those things that people are afraid to talk about, but my concern is the story we're being told culturally about sex and the way we all are kind of feeling about sex are two different things. And it's the lack of conversation about our sexuality, or, you know, are we sexual because we're in an intimate relationship? Are we sexual just because we're animals and the biology drives us? It's a little bit of both. How did you learn about sex for the first time? Do you feel like you had adequate sexual information? And if so, or if not, what is it that we need to teach young people so that they're prepared to have healthy relationships? Then do you feel like you found yourself in your adult life as having a healthy sexual relationship? And what did it take to get there? Because my feeling, having, you know, worked for 20 plus years with couples and, you know, being in a long-term marriage myself, is that it's a struggle for relationships. You know, you can have the most intimate relationship with someone. You can share children together. You can pay a mortgage together. You can talk about, you know, the hurts in your life. But then when it comes down to talking about your sexual desires or your sexual feelings or how you would like things to be when you're intimate with each other, all wheels can come off the cart for those relationships. And so how do we find our way back to having conversations? And I have some ideas about what I think we need to help our children understand and know, but I'm curious to know what you think. 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of the conversation. And, you know, it's important that we look at sexuality from kind of this full, rounded perspective. And, you know, in our own sex education in this country, for a country, again, that feels like it's sexually liberated and that you can, you know, access porn on every device, which, you know, now for young people has become their version of a sex education, is what they see in pornography. But it's not teaching them anything about the emotional connection or the physical nurturing. And it's just the physical act we're talking about. So how do we get comfortable as a culture talking about the full experience of sexuality, not just with our children, but also with our partners? Hi, Dave, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi, Elizabeth. Well, you mentioned the 60s and the revolution.
Yes.
I think back, one other thing that went out the window in those days was organized religion or people's tendency to want to be part of a religious experience. And one of the things, I was raised Catholic, one of the things I was raised with is the concept of a commitment, mm-hmm. and that sex was something reserved for marriage. And during that revolution, that's one of the things that went out the window, was sex is something that can be enjoyed outside of marriage. And so that's, I think, one of the things today that's been disconnected. I didn't hear you say the word commitment, but you might just go somewhere from there.
No. No, Dave, thank you, because I think that's one of the hard conversations. We don't have a cultural norm for how we teach values, right, to our children. I think our religious affiliation for a lot of times, for a lot of people, was where they expected sexual values to be taught to their children, or that's, you know, the sexual values they passed along. And so because we don't have a unified way of talking about sex and sexuality and commitment and, you know, how the two work together, how do we broach this topic, you know, as parents? And are our religious organizations the best place for teaching sex and sexuality?
Yes, I think one of the things is, as far as sex being intended for marriage, I think that's one of the things I was raised with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the things that I think isn't emphasized very much, is that it's something that's for a man and a woman to be bonded together in marriage. Was something that was created for that specific purpose. In fact, sexuality is one of the amazing things of all living things, is the sexuality of how they reproduce.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of miss that, I think, a lot. We think of it as an object, as something that we somehow fulfill ourselves with sex, where we don't fulfill ourselves. It's really something for a committed relationship. But I think in the 60s, that got kind of thrown out the window.
Yeah, I think in the way of trying to throw out the repression, right, of the 50s, everything got thrown out the window along with it. And I think the other, and thank you for calling, Dave, when I think the other struggles is that people aren't getting married at 20 and 21 as they did in the 50s and 60s or even 22. You know, if we're delaying marriage much later, then you have a lot of people who enter their sexual identity or getting comfortable with their sexual identity in their late teens. And then they have, you know, 15 years where they're kind of navigating the world through dating and relationships before they settle down and make a commitment to another person and maintain marriage within that committed relationship. So how do we teach sex and sexuality through all those years where you're kind of a sexual nomad and going out, kind of figuring out how that all works? 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of this conversation. Hey, Bill, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Well, am I on the air now?
Yes, you are. How are you?
Oh, okay, I'm fine. I think you were just touching on it with the last comment or two. Mm-hmm. I've been married for almost 60 years. I've got 5 children. All of them have been married, a couple of them twice. And I have 13 grandchildren. And it doesn't look like these grandchildren are at all interested in getting married. I'd like to have great-grandchildren someday. And they, several of them are in relationships with people, but they just don't seem to want to get married anymore. I wish, it's frustrating.
And so what do you think happens then for these young people, Bill? Should we be teaching them abstinence until they're married in their 30s? Maybe that would make them get married younger.
No, I don't think so. But when my wife and I were dating, it's a long time ago, this is very old-fashioned, and we were religious Catholics. And, you know, if you want to have sex, well, you got married. Of course, we cheated a little, like everybody, I suppose. But that was kind of the way you did it. And today, it's entirely different. I'm just wondering about this feminine revolution, the sexual revolution, the pill, all of that. And just on a broad scale, too, demographically, we're looking down a bad pipe here where we got fewer and fewer babies coming along and more old people. It just concerns me.
Well, Bill, thank you for sharing that. And I think that's kind of why I wanted to have this conversation, because, you know, the old story of we find someone, we get married, sex is kind of within the marriage, and now it's all safely bottled up and contained, that model has changed. And so how do, you know, but the thing that hasn't changed, and I think this is the point I keep wanting to make, and I'm not getting there, is that in research that Helen Fisher's done and Esther Perel and John Gottman and a lot of these therapists who work in the world of sex and sexuality in relationships, is that what hasn't changed is the brain circuitry that drives us towards wanting to be in relationship, that drives us towards wanting to be in committed, attached relationships with another person where we feel cared for, we're with someone who's dependable, and that the sex and sexuality of those relationships, you know, kind of all comes together. That hasn't changed. And so we have this disconnect between, you know, wanting to be in these long-term committed relationships at later and later ages. But what do we do with that desire to want to be connected and intimate and emotionally supported by another person? You know, it seems that a lot of people are trying to kind of fill that gap with casual sex or hookup sex or, you know, just kind of sex for the physical act of it, but they're not getting that same feeling, that depth of connection that they have in long-term committed relationships. But what's not going to change is we're not going to start having young people get married at 18 and 20. So how do we replicate that? How do we create intimacy and connection and attachment without being in a marriage?
Could I comment one more time about something?
No, please do.
Okay. More specifically, I have a granddaughter, lovely, lovely. She's going to be 30. And I have a very, very dear close friend who is also about 30. And they both had steady boyfriends. One of them still does. The other one's just breaking up with one. And I'm finding that in both cases, and that's certainly not something you can generalize about, but I still think that emotional wiring you're talking about is stronger in women, and they really would like to get married. I know these two would. But with the guys, I mean, like Elvis Presley said one time or something, why buy a cow when you get free milk through the fence?
My grandmother said that to me when I was young, too. I think that is an old story. But I think, though, Bill, that the young men also have the same drive towards attachment and commitment. And I think we're talking about a bigger cultural story. And it kind of goes back to what is it that we have taught young people in the last two generations that's different than what we focused on in generations before that? Because, you know, 50 years ago, when you were raising kids and when I was young, you know, that story of finding a partner and getting married and building a family, that was the primary story that men and women both were told. And then, you know, when we had the sexual revolution and the feminist movement and the kind of the sexual liberation of the 60s and lots of women going back to work and kind of this focus changed from being about creating a family and then your work supported the family, to being about creating your work, your career as your primary focus, and then trying to fit a family within that somewhere. And so when we changed our focus, you know, the millennials were taught from a young age to really be about success and career and finding their sense of value and purpose in their work. And then somehow along the way, they were supposed to also get married and have a family. But none of those skills were ever taught or even valued. You know, as parents, I think we did our children a disservice by saying, don't get married too young, get a career, you know, don't settle down. And so you have all these young people who have the feelings and desires for attachment and commitment, but they're being told that's not something you should value. Ignore that message and focus on your work, because that's what it's all about. I mean, did you...
You nailed it.
All right. Thanks for calling in, Bill.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I brought up the conversation today about sex, and can we talk about it? And is it something that you're comfortable talking about with your spouse? Do you have conversations about what feels good or how you would like to be together? Have you kept it kind of novel? Do you try new things? And if you're modeling a loving, healthy relationship for your children, you know, they have a 75% higher, they have a 75% chance of having a better quality relationship because you've modeled a healthy relationship than if they never see anything from their parents. So having a healthy conversation, having the ability to work through problems with our spouses, the ability to maintain long-term romantic love in a marriage is a great way of passing that value down to our children. But the conversation that we aren't having or should be having is, what are the overall values that we're passing down to our children? Are we even teaching them to value relationships? You know, we came out of disastrous 70s and 80s and high divorce rates and, you know, multiple marriages. And so the young people are gun shy about getting into any sort of committed relationship. And so they're trying to have sex without commitment or attachment. But our biology, the dopamine and oxytocin that are released when we have sex, especially if you have, you know, an orgasm, it releases more oxytocin. These chemicals drive our biology to want to attach and connect to the person we're having sex with. And yet we're trying not to get attached to anyone. So how do we expect anyone to have healthy relationships? 805-781-3875. Hi, Erica, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Well, when I was a younger girl, I was often told that girls use sex for love and boys use love for sex. And I think in my experience, that was fairly true. But now, as a woman in my 40s, I still can't talk to my mom about sex at all, even though I've been married for 15 or so years. So there was some divide set up, even though they talked to me, my parents talked to me about sex, but in a very biological way, and in that way that, you know, you have sex with somebody that you love. But the problem was, I think that the biological feelings that I had, I didn't always as I grew into my sexual person, I didn't always feel that I loved the person I was enjoying having sex with. Mm-hmm. So I was always very confused, still couldn't talk to my folks about it. But now that I have children of my own, I think about this a lot. My husband and I have a very good conversation about sex. And I know that now that sex is, positive sex is so much about communication. And even if I look back on the sex that I would say was positive and enjoyable, it was, whether or not it was a person that I loved, it was somebody that I had good communication with. Mm-hmm. So how I turned that into for my own children was still wrestling with the guilt levels that I was laden with of, you know, you have sex in a committed relationship, very challenging for somebody of my, in my generation.
I agree. And you know, I don't have the easy answer for it. So I don't want anyone to think that I'm like holding back the right answer. And then I'm going to tell you, because I think it is a conversation that we're still trying to figure out. Because the reality is, you know, if you're raising children, you want to teach them sexual values. But if they're not going to get married until they're 30 or 31, and they're going to be sexual around 17, 18 years old, what are the lessons you want them to have? How to access contraception? You know, that would be important. your family values about, you know, ideally being in an attached, committed relationship. And the good news is that most young people who've had sex education, who have had access to contraception, have had conversations about healthy relationships, those young people have their first sexual experiences 90% of the time with someone they're actually in a committed relationship to. And it's those children that are taught abstinence only or sign purity pledges, they are more likely to have sex with random hookups or strangers because they've been taught, you know, so much of the guilt and you only have sex in marriage. And so the interesting thing about sex education and teaching sexual values to our children is that the more that we normalize those sexual feelings at a young age and give children access to information of how to have healthy sexual relationships, they tend to gravitate towards committed relationships to have sexual relationships in. And it's when we try to hide sex or demonize it or put shame around it or make children afraid of sex, they tend to then get drunk or numb themselves or have risky behavior sex without contraception more often because they're following their biological urge for sex, but in unsafe ways. How does that work for you, Erica?
Well, that all sounds good. I think communication is really foundational. And I think extending that communication to your kids is important. And then going back to them and communicating, not waiting necessarily for them to come back to you, because that may never happen. But, another thing I wanted to say I appreciated was your comment about therapists not having a lot of training and talking about sex, because I think because I had to deal with some issues of intimacy related to sexuality early in life, mm-hmm. I had to go through therapy to address those. And the person that I was working with was very skilled at walking someone through that. And without that therapy, I don't know how long or if I would have ever been comfortable talking about and exploring my sexuality. So I found that piece very interesting, but communication.
It's absolutely very big. Absolutely communication.
Thanks.
And I'm glad you found a clinician, because that is key. The person that you shared this with has to be able to hold your story in a way that you feel safe. And so fortunately you found someone who could go to that place with you. And that makes me happy, Erica. Thank you for calling in.
Thanks.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Our number is 805-781-3875. Hi, Sally. You're on the air. What's on your mind?
Well, first of all, I want to say I've been married 56 years. And in my day, we wanted to save ourselves for the man we were going to marry.
Mm-hmm.
And I also wanted my husband to be not sexually with anybody else. I wanted him to be a virgin, too. And so I just felt like, it just is so intimate that if you start having sex with all kinds of other partners, you're really never going to be happy in life. Like nowadays, the girls go out and the men, and they have sex maybe on the first or second date. And then they go the next month and have sex with somebody else. So how could you really, in your mind, psychologically, be satisfied ever?
Well, I think that's a kind of one of the questions that we're having is, I don't know if you have grandchildren, but if they're going to get married at, 25, 30 years old, are we expecting them to not be sexual then until they're 30?
No, that's a hard thing because my own children were having sex before they got married. And it seems like we go along with everything nowadays. Everything is okay because we're not going to give up our children because they were even living with their girlfriends before they got married. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I love them and I didn't say anything to them. I mean, I just felt like that's their life. And if they want to live it that way, that's fine. But it happened that they did marry the girls they were living with, which was good. And they are good people. So it's just a hard situation nowadays because people do get married older.
Mm-hmm.
And, I guess it's going to be like that. that's just the way life is now. Everything changes.
It does. And I think, Sally, thank you for your perspective. I think that that is the challenge, is that we can't bury our head in the sand and say, well, we, you know, let's just hope it all goes back to the, you know, the way it used to be. And again, it doesn't mean that necessarily because we waited till we got married to have sex, that the sex within that marriage was ever really that great. I mean, you can grow your intimacy if you have good communication, if you're patient with each other. You know, good sex in a healthy relationship far outweighs, you know, casual sex, because when you have that sense of commitment and attachment and safety and dependability, you know, it brings a richness to the sexual experience that you don't get in that same kind of hot, heavy, fast and furious, which also can be really exciting at different times in your life. I mean, the thing that we haven't really talked about is that drive for sexual gratification and that drive for romantic love and feelings of attachment actually, you know, reside in two different places in our brain. They're not totally connected. That the sexual gratification drive is all attached to testosterone, and it's kind of that lust drive that drives us to mate and procreate and carry on the species. But in the human brain, that other part, that desire for attachment and romantic love, that's also a survival mechanism in the brain, but it was more about, you know, kind of the safety, how we find someone that we can protect each other from the wilderness, you know, that we can be in a nurturing, safe space. But the two don't necessarily always arrive together at the same time, that there will be periods of time in our life that we might just be sexual in a physical way, without the long-term attachment and romantic love. But what is true about sex, whether it's casual or committed, the hormones that are released during the sexual act are always about attachment and bonding. Those are the chemicals that are released when your genitals are stimulated, dopamine and oxytocin. So the conflict or the challenge has always been, how do we take care of ourselves emotionally if we are entering into sexual relationships that aren't going to be about long-term commitment, right? But we have to deal with the feelings that come up. And within long-term committed relationships, how do we maintain the novelty and excitement and pleasure around sexual excitement in a long-term relationship that's about kind of feeling settled and committed and attached? Because attachment and dependability and familiarity and predictability doesn't always equate well with eroticism and sexual excitement, which a lot of people desire in their lives also. So there's three different conversations here. One is, what do children and young people need to know? What do we as parents want to teach them so that they're prepared for having a healthy sexual life and identity without shame and guilt? How do we maintain the healthy sexual relationship within our marriages? And how do we feel about casual hookup sex just for the sexual gratification part? 805-781-3875. Hi, Aaron, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi there. I am 25, and I kind of wanted to speak as far as from the perspective of someone who's my age. And, you know, in relationship to this whole thing of people my age aren't really getting married soon enough, or we don't seem to commit very well. To be honest with you, it's because I was 10 when like 9/11 happened. The internet became a thing when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. We see all of these big powers moving that we have no control over, and we see an economic future where the deck is kind of stacked against us. Most of us are trying to figure out just how to live, you know. And it's hard to look forward and say I want to get married to a person and have kids when you're trying to figure out just how to continue to have the quality of life that maybe you were lucky enough to get, you know?
Can I ask you some questions? Are you feeling comfortable to talk with me?
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Okay. I'm just...
No. When I get a 25-year-old, I want to pick your brain a little bit. Do you feel also that the, you know, availability of porn and hookups, did that impact your feelings about sexuality? Did you have sex ed when you were in high school?
Yeah, well, I had sex ed at a public school, and it didn't really answer all of my questions, so I did turn to the internet, and there was a time there when I wasn't allowed to be on the internet, and it was dial-up. So, you know, it was an interesting way to grow up. It's definitely, it was my perspective at least, that I could go and get questions answered for myself outside of conventional means. And a lot of the time, yeah, that free information, supplemented conversations that that parents or authority figures could have jumped on, but, you know, we kind of, people my age kind of went out to answer our own questions, I guess.
So then my question is, I understand, you know, kind of growing up under the shadow of uncertainty, which I don't know if it makes you feel any better, Aaron, but that I think that is common with almost every generation, because I remember growing up.
Universal, I'm sure.
Pardon me?
I'm sure it's universal.
I think it is. And I remember my dad saying to me, since the beginning of time, they've been predicting the end of the world, and every generation right. has their end of the world. And it just feels more dire. I mean, clearly things are happening rapidly now, but it always seems dire. And I think with all the technology and information and 24/7 in your face, you know, reminders about cataclysmic disasters, it would be difficult to ever feel calm and relaxed enough to have hope. So I think it's harder on you for that reason. But I also had brought up earlier that your generation was raised with the focus on your value being in what you did for your career, and we didn't really talk to you about family and home and children in a nurturing way. And I'm wondering if that was a message that you didn't get, or what message did you get about what you should be valuing?
Yeah, well, I definitely got the message of focus on yourself, try to grow yourself, and try to live this sort of life of purpose and be a net positive in the life you live. And I'm not sure. I guess that is a growing trend among my generation, but it was done with the best of intention. And,
absolutely.
My parents had me when they were like 30. I had more opportunities because of that. And I think that, you know, when people my age look on, you know, go online and look at just the ratios of CEO pay to ground floor pay for, you know, the U.S. versus, say, Europe, I mean, yeah, we see that the deck is kind of stacked against us, and that we need to survive before we can thrive.
And it makes me, I almost want to cry, and I so understand how you feel this way, and because I'm with college students every day and I hear the same stories. And so the old hippie in me, and let me just say that I wasn't a hippie originally, but I'm sure. Feeling like I'm going to tout some old hippie things. That's why, you know, my concern is I wish we'd spent more time talking to you about nurturing relationships and finding that person that you want to, you know, walk this journey with and focus on that, and then let life kind of play out around that relationship. Instead of feeling like you have to have yourself set up in your house hunter's ideal house with your CEO pay before you can think about settling down and having children, because to me that's backwards. If you talk to, you know, my callers earlier who've been married 60 years, my guess is that every single one of them were dirt poor when they got married, but between the two of them, they kind of found the path. And if you look back over your life, the most phenomenal time in your life were the years you struggled with young children and trying to make ends meet and pay your mortgage. And that I think we've switched things really sadly in our culture, that you're supposed to hit the pinnacle and then fit a family in, instead of, you know, enjoying the journey with someone and growing this family and these opportunities together. And if you end up in a shack down by the river, you're happily in that shack down by the river, because ultimately all that really mattered was finding that person you want to share that journey with.
And right, but in that, you know, in that shack scenario that you were talking about, I mean, what happened, I suppose maybe part of this generational shift is the fact that some people did get to that shack and weren't happy, you know, mm-hmm. and some people's lives have been negatively impacted by not thinking it through enough before having kids. And I mean, there are those stories too. And I feel that maybe, perhaps there was an overcorrection,
maybe.
At some point, you know,
I agree. And I think they're always trying to find the balance, but I worry more now. I would rather have more people end up in the shack and go, huh, that wasn't the best plan, how do we work this out, than get to be 45 and say, wow, I forgot the part about having a family and finding personal joy. And that big house I got and the money I made didn't satisfy me in the least, because I think ultimately, you know, that materialistic drive, that consumer drive that you've been taught to value is much more empty than you'll ever imagine.
I'm absolutely with you on that.
I know. I wish we could talk all day, Aaron, but I have to jump. Thank you for sending the millennial message to us.
Thank you.
I am Elizabeth Barrett. I forgot who I was for a moment. We've been talking about sex today. I wish we had another hour to talk about it, because it looks like our phone lines are blowing up. I can grab a couple quick thoughts. Bill, you got about 30 seconds. What's on your mind?
Okay. This will take longer, but I was just hoping that someone would bring up the historical perspective about how people were designed. And we were designed to have children at 13 or 14 mm-hmm. and have as many of them as possible to help on the farm or help hunt food. And, you know, and things kind of got misinterpreted since then.
Well, and I think, Bill, thank you for calling, because I think the other part of the historical information is that we also died at 40. And then so once you had kids, it was all over, and then you kind of were done. Now we're living to 80, 90, 100 years old. So we're talking about, you know, developing a sexual experience or a sexual relationship for a long time. If you start at 18 and you go until you're 85, you know, it's a long time to not enjoy being sexual or enjoying your body. So here's a couple things I want to leave you with. If you're in a stable, you know, long-term union, the ways that you kind of maintain that sexual health, yes, communication is important. Novelty, do things together, go on trips, try new activities, cook food together. Cooking is very erotic. It doesn't always have to be about the sexual. Stay in touch with each other, hold hands when you walk places, say nice things to each other. Cultivate a practice of positive illusions, which I love. Positive illusions are when we focus on the things that we like about another and not the things we don't like, because you can get really caught up in the negative. So positive illusions help to build that long-term romantic attachment and sexual connection. Cultivate empathy for the others. Cultivate and controlling your emotions. And then for the general conversation about sex and sexuality and culture, I think it's really important to keep considering that if we are going to delay marriage, if we're going to delay, you know, long-term committed relationships, to realize that even within that hookup culture, young people really are still striving to feel like they are attached or seen or connected to others. And the research shows that children who have the most information about sex and sexuality from a young age have the healthiest relationships. It doesn't make them more sexually active with multiple partners. Conversely, it actually, with the right information and access to contraception and information about communication sexuality, they're more likely to enter into more stable relationships with young people for longer periods of time. So just some things to consider. Hopefully it starts a conversation for you and your significant others tonight. As always, I appreciate you participating in these conversations. We'll be back again next Tuesday at 2. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. This show will be available on podcast through iTunes and at kcbx.org. I leave you with a little mood music. Thank you for supporting Public Radio KCBX.
let your love come down.